Hello, I'm James Lilex, and this is The Diner. On the air since 1997, on the web since 2005, and now available in handy portable podcast form. It's Friday, January 13th, 2006. It's hard to believe it's almost been 10 years since I started coming to the diner. The place hasn't changed at all, as far as I can tell. Still out on old Highway 23. Still looks like, well, exactly like you would imagine a diner to look like. Has a long boomerang pattern Formica counter, which hides nearly every spill you can possibly imagine. Which is odd, because it's turquoise with red accents, and, you know, there's not a lot of food served that's turquoise, but it's the damnedest thing. You can pour gravy on this thing, and people will still manage to put their elbows into it. It's got these stools that you can spin around on, which are always fun. And if you're a kid, it's a great way to make yourself nauseated. It has a Crosley television set up in the corner, which is usually turned off for good. But in case breaking news happens and we absolutely have to access a cathode ray tube, there it is. The only change, as far as I can tell since the last time I've been here, is that the jukebox, the old Rockola in the corner, is gone and has been replaced by individual jukeboxes at every desk, every table, and every stool here. Now, there are 12 stools along the counter, and everybody has their own jukebox. If everyone accesses these things individually, it's going to be cacophony, but luckily I'm the only one here tonight. The other change is that if you're a longtime patron of the diner, you'll recall that there is a massive mainframe Cray computer in the basement, which I've used over the years to access nearly any single piece of pop culture that I want. Well, I've got an interface now with it, with my laptop here. I brought it and hooked it together with some firewire and baling cable and toothpicks and all the rest of it, so I can just type now and get what I want to get. I no longer have to go through the tedious process of voice requests, which rather seems like a step backwards when you think about it. Anyway, here we are, back at the diner. Happy to be here in 2006, so let's begin. Well, there's one other thing that's different. I have a new microphone. The old crappy USB thing that I've been barking into for the last 6 or 7 months or so has been replaced by a blue snowball. A snowball that's white and called the Blue. I like it a lot. And it's made in Russia. This is quite surprising to me. I'm from a demographic that still is amazed that you can buy anything from Russia. When I was growing up, Russia made nothing but atom bombs and communists and scary hammers and sickles. You know, when I was a kid, there was something just about that hammer and sickle thing that just made me nervous. Never mind what it stood for. I mean, what country has a national symbol that can poke you? But I digress. I was just surprised to see that it was made in Russia and gratified and happy. And then I open it up and find that it was designed in Latvia, which is even better because, again, when I was a kid, Latvia was the country that Dr. Doom ran. Of course, it's Latveria. But still, Latvia and Russia are providing the technological wherewithal that enables this bleepcast to be a little better than the others. And I thought that perhaps, in order to inaugurate this, that we should go back to some really crappy proto-podcasting from the 1960s. To a gentleman who, for reasons that we may never know, other than the desire for fame, which of course is a powerful motivator, decided to sit down in front of a cheap little recording machine and make a demo tape for, I presume, some Nashville bigwig. This was his shot at stardom. He didn't even play an instrument, but he had a song in his head, and he was determined that if he sang this song to the guy, well, fame and fortune and riches and a spot in the Grand Ole Opry and chance to feel up Minnie Pearl would no doubt result. This showed up a couple of years ago in the 365 Project, which is a great website that just pulled out peculiar bits of found art and odd audio oddities and let everybody in the internet download them for free. I saved the whole thing. Artist unknown. Name of track unknown, but it's gone down in history, of course, simply as Blue. Podcasting, circa 1964.
Testing 1, 2, 3, I'm Tennessee Green. This is known as the Big Black Cat Concert. We'll start this concert. Here we got a donkey coming in, so maybe we won't. Maybe we'll forget it, you know. We'll both be well off and famous, all right? Maybe you can produce me or get me on a record, get me on the shelf, okay? and see what we can get going here, where I can get a little money before I can get off the ground level. I'd appreciate that a lot, you know, see if we can get something going here, all right? Maybe you're trying to get something going for yourself, I don't know. You know, small guy like me probably don't mean that much to a big fat cat. But maybe I do. You know, maybe you are greedy and want more money. You can't never tell. This is a good one right here. I sing about blue. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody sing about blue. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody sing about blue. I sing about blue too. 5'2", cutie cute. Yes, I sing about blue too. Twist it, shake it, you can't break it. I'm in love with you. Come on, come on. Tell me you love me too. Yes, I sing about blue. Yes, I sing about blue.
Well, you get the pith of his gist. He's singing about blue. And I'm talking about Blue the Microphone. That's the sort of transition that you just can't make up. You gotta write it. You gotta sit down and script that sucker out. The blue here, while it's nice, is heavy, but it's not as... Well, the best microphone I ever knew, period, was the one at KSTP, which was so lovingly oiled that no matter how much you moved the thing around, it never issued a squeak, which, of course, you'd expect out of professional equipment. But the first microphone that I ever had was a small little Magnavox that was attached to a cassette recorder that I got as a birthday present, I believe, in 1969. And I know the year because I took that microphone and that little cassette recorder and went to Northport Shopping Center next door to my house and asked people at random what they thought of the Apollo space program. I would just walk up to them and stick the microphone in their face and ask them questions. And that was the last piece of actual journalism I think I ever did. But everyone was apparently so charmed by the sight of a young man, dorky though he was, with glasses. I looked like a reporter even then. I was a little pudgy and overweight, and I had stupid glasses and a short haircut and no fashion sense whatsoever, and I'd stick the microphone in their face and ask for their opinion on the Apollo project. I have no idea what happened to that tape, but I had two tapes, one of which I used for recording my own radio shows in 69, and the other of which came with the tape recorder, part of a promotional gift. To this day, I will never forget it, ever, because it made a deep impression on me. It was the most mysterious piece of music I ever had heard. And years later, I managed to track it down. This was the first thing that I ever heard coming out of this wonderful device, the cassette player. Tiny, tiny, micro, small little cassettes. Who imagined that humanity could get to the point where we could shrink down an album of music to something the size of a deck of playing cards? It was just stunned the mind. Men on the Moon, cassette players, and music. Well, music is up to date and as modern and forward-looking as this, the first cassette I ever owned. And that, of course, is Martin Denny, the famous Quiet Village. The title of the tune is meant ironically, of course, since, obviously, the village isn't very quiet. It makes you wonder how anybody in the Polynesian Islands got a moment's sleep. When my father bought that for me in 1969, he probably got it at the cutout bin at Ben Franklin, because that was recorded in 1959 by Denny at the tail end of the Polynesian tiki craze. Listening to it again, I think that the sounds of the various fauna of the islands were recorded by human beings and not actual birds. I mean, listen to this guy. Yeah, it sounds like he's getting a prostate exam from a guy wearing a sandpaper glove. So why did my father buy me Martin Denny's Quiet Village? Why did he think that this 1959 piece of Polynesian kitsch would appeal to his son? Well, probably because he went down and looked at the records that I was playing when I sat in the basement working on my model rockets. And what was the one that was worn practically smooth? It was this one. Thank you. That's right, the Hawaii Five-O soundtrack. I had it, I memorized it. I loved Hawaii Five-O, and so my father assumed that if I liked Hawaii Five-O, which was set in Polynesia, I would naturally like 1959 kitschy Polynesian tiki lounge music, and he was right. But in 69, I was at the cusp of the edge of the precipice of teenhood, and I had not yet grasped an essential truth, which is that it would be very important for me quickly to adapt a style of music that would drive my parents crazy. I mean, in 69, I liked the usual mix of stuff that kids like. I had the Sound of Music soundtrack. I listened to still songs from the Jungle Book. I was listening to pop songs from the radio, but I didn't quite get them yet. And then, in 1970, came a record that just changed my life completely and turned me into somebody who listened to Grieg and Schumann's piano concertos into a 12-year-old idiot addled by popular culture and proud of it. It was the 1970 KTEL Top 10 compilation, and I can see it to this day. It had a yellow cover, it had black lettering, and oh, the songs on that album. Yes, I had finally accepted pop music into my life. It had finally spoken to me, and it was 1970. Great timing, eh? Well, the record had Band of Gold by Frida Payne. It had Mr. Big Stuff by Honeycomb. Who do you think you are, anyway? Ooh, Child by the Stair Steps. Shocking Blue by Venus, or Shocking Venus by Blue. All those great songs from 1970, which are not, of course, technically great in the least bit, but if you lived through them, they bring a certain smile to your face when you hear them on the radio and make you feel old and that it's time for the prostate exam with a sandpaper glove. But even then, there was a song on this record that struck me wrong. A song that I just knew was just not quite right. Didn't know what he was after, although I wouldn't let on to any of my friends, of course. I hated that song. I think it was the first one on the album, and I just hated it. I skipped over it every single time, and I wonder sometimes if my entire... Well, back up for a second. Rap, rap, rap. They call him the rapper. Boy, you know, those hippies of 1970, they had a flair for nomenclature, didn't they? Here's the guy who sleeps. We call him the sleeper. This guy falls face down, down, down in his ramen noodles all the time. We call him the downer. And over here is the guy who sticks needles in his arms. We call him the sticker. Me? I explain. They call me the explainer man. Anyway, perhaps my entire distaste for rap music boils down to some elemental instruction implanted in my brain by the song The Rapper, which just associated forever those particular phonemes with music I don't like. Not entirely fair. Not that I don't like all rap. For example, oh man, you gotta love this.
Stop what you're doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. I look funny, but yo, I'm making money, see? So yo, world, I hope you're ready for me. Now gather round, I'm the new fool in town, and my sound's laid down by the underground. I drink a ball of Hennessy you got on your shelf, so just let me introduce myself. My name is Humpty, pronounced with the umpty. Yo, ladies, oh, how I like to funk thee. And all the rappers in the top 10, please allow me to bump thee. I'm stepping tall, y'all.
Okay, I'm sorry, I like the Humpty Dance. That's Digital Underground, in case you're curious. I've always liked the Humpty Dance. As a matter of fact, I learned a lot, because there's always something in every genre that I like. It doesn't matter how much I don't... I mean, bluegrass, for example. I don't like bluegrass. I've described it as hillbilly techno, unplugged. And aren't I just the cleverest chap? But I don't like it. It doesn't speak to me. But every once in a while, I'll find a bluegrass tune that I love because I've given it the Humpty exception. So there's always something out there in every genre that I like, but rap, generally, no. So I was conflicted then at some point about, let's move, shall we say, 13 years away from being in the basement and making model airplanes, Estes, I should note, to the 1970 KTEL record. I was working in the Valley in Dickeytown in a bar where actual smoking was allowed, if you can imagine that. 3-2 beer and greasy pizza, one of the best times of my life. Worked there for 6-7 years. Formative years. Formative experience, but that's another diner podcast. And one of the tunes that came on the jukebox, which was played every night, time after time after time again, brought me great pain. Because what it was a group that I'd well admired because they were new wave. Man, they were part of the whole red leather, thin lapel, skinny tie movement that I regarded myself as part of. Why, their first hit had even been vaguely electronic in a sort of post-Kraftwerk sense. So imagine my absolute crestfallen stunnedness when they came out with this. Blondie's Rapture. The one unforgivable sin of the 80s. Are you sure you could make the point that New Wave actually died with Heart of Glass with its quasi-pseudo-Giorgio Moroder overtones, but go ahead, make that point. You don't have a life. And I'll gladly argue it with you over a beer someday. But the point is, I memorized Deborah Harry's stupid rap. I had no choice. It was playing 30 times a night, and the only way I could keep myself sane was to learn it and impress the girls with my ability to just mouth it robotically. And the man from space comes down and he eats your face, and you get in the car and you don't go far and you don't stop, etc. God almighty. But, you know, this really is the golden age of pop music, because not only are there interesting things being done today, but we have the entirety of pop music that precedes us to play with. People can take music and reform it to suit their needs. You can take a tune like Blondie's Rapture, you can look at it and say, well, you know, there is a beat there. There is a certain identifiable structure. There is something, there is a hook. And it does say 1980 whatever to a lot of people. Can this song be saved? Is there something in it that's intrinsically good that we can bring back to life and make it worth our time again? Well, you know what? The answer is yes. It goes on for another 7 minutes like that, almost twice as long as the original. And it doesn't have Deborah Harry's rap. Hallelujah. Saints be praised. They took out the rap and stripped it down to the bass and the jangly guitars and made a better song out of it. No, it's not great. It's not Shakespeare. It's not Beethoven. It's not Handel or Haydn or even Bix Beiderbecke saying a cornet solo. And don't ask me why I threw Shakespeare in the mix there. I think he wrote a song in one of the plays. In one of the plays, I think there's actual musical notation for a song, if I remember correctly. But in any case, no, it's just, it is what it is. It's music to get speeding tickets by, or bump nasty on the weekends at a dance club somewhere, or even do your taxes by, or write by. It's the sort of stuff that I play when I don't particularly want to spend a lot of intellectual energy on what I'm listening to. But just want to groove my thang. Sorry, I apologize. Anyway, that's European, I believe. Probably just a couple of guys who got together in 2001 to remix that for their own purposes. A lot of the good stuff that's being remixed now comes out of Europe. These guys are good at reassembling and reconverting American music. They're just not very good at making it themselves. I've always noticed this. When it comes to directly aping most American styles, the Europeans just screw the pooch. They could not do jazz in the 30s. Johnny Holiday is supposedly France's answer to Elvis Presley, and that's exactly what he sounds like. There are a few good punk groups, and I don't count Britain in this. I mean the continental Europe. The Parisians, the Belgians, the Germans are very good at remixing, but the only good punk, I believe, to come out of the whole era was Plastique Bertrand with Sa Plante Pour Moi, which was pretty good, even though it was the same song that went over and over and over again until you were eventually tired of it, but still a good punk tune. They really can't do it, though, when it comes to directly copying American music, which leads me to this. And in retrospect, it appears that I have been leading up to something. An excuse to play one of the worst things I have ever found in my life. A track that answers the question, what would it sound like if Dutchman rapped?
Heft de rood niet af met een kung fu krachten. Je vierde mijn mond de metaforen zijn prachtig. Ik spaar in niemand, vier jaar afstanden. Vind een weer inspiratie van uw moeder en drachten. Ola op mijn fouten, nu ben ik kwaad. Ze zet ze niet vuil, ze hebben een vet. Kan het niet overzweet, moeten weer begin. Naaf is uw moeder en Homer Simpson een dun. Water van een piem en Chinese muur. Maar dat ik kinderspaal, verleent me daar een heur. Ketels patchouli, kan de stang niet verdunnen. Een schande voor de zwast, maar kan ze niet verschillen.
Sorry. Sorry about that. And I guess I owe them a new jukebox here at the counter. put it on my tab. Yeah. You'll notice they made a brief reference to Homer Simpson there. The Europeans don't even have their own fat, cartoonish, oafish archetypes that they can refer to. They gotta borrow from Americans. Well, I don't know if it's German or Dutch or Belgian or whatever. I just know that it's a rap and I say it's spinach and to hell with it. So there you go. Well, the good news is that the band is setting up for a live performance here in just a few minutes. Now that they took the main jukebox out, there's space in the corner for a band to play, and they're plugging in and getting ready to go. So we'll have them provide some sort of musical palate cleanser, sherbet, if you will, to take our ears and minds off this utterly unexpected peregrination into rap and why I don't like it and why it goes back to me being in the basement in 1970 and making model rockets to the sound of a K-Tel record. Good Lord. So we'll get to the band in just a second, but first, a word from our sponsor.
You boys and girls won't object to Grove's emulsified nose drops. There's nothing unpleasant about them. They don't run out of your nose and make you messy. They don't run down the back of your throat and make you sickish. What's more, they don't burn or sting the inside of your nose. They quickly check a head cold and yet do it in a nice way. These nose drops are something brand new and a big improvement on old-fashioned oil drops. Mother is interested in getting results when you have a cold in the head, and she'll get results much faster with Grove's emulsified nose drops. In every section of the country, Grove's emulsified nose drops are selling at an amazing rate. That's because they are better in every way. Tell Mother to procure a bottle at the corner drugstore. Grove's emulsified nose drops will surprise you with the way they look and act. These nose drops are white and creamy. They don't look, taste, or smell like medicine, yet they are highly effective. That's because they are medically superior, because they stay up in the nose. Any child can understand that nose drops that stay up in the nose will do more good than nose drops that run right out. Impress this fact upon Mother, and she will undoubtedly let you try these new type nose drops when you have a head cold or stuffed head. All drugstores sell Grove's emulsified nose drops, and they're really more economical than the old-fashioned kind because you get more for your money and because you can use less. Ask Mother to get a bottle today.
Thank you, and we'll all keep that in mind next time we want some emulsification up our nostrils. Well, the band is ready to go. As I said, I have no idea who these people are. The lead singer is a rather peculiar-looking fellow. He looks to be in about his mid-50s or so, gaunt. He's dressed in overalls, and he has five teeth. Wide, manic grin and a happy glint in his eyes. I have no idea what they're going to perform. All right, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for whoever the band is here at the diner tonight with a song, the name of which I have no idea, but it can't be worse than anything we've heard so far.
Testing 1, 2, 3, I'm Tennessee Green. This is known as the Big Black Cat Concert.
This is a good one right here. I sang about blue. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody sang about blue. Everybody, everybody, everybody. Everybody sang about blue. You can't break it. I'm in love with you. Come on, come on.
Produce me or get me on a record, get me on the show.
Okay, small guy like me probably don't mean that much to a big fat cat. But maybe I do. If I hear anybody singing these that ain't producing me, then you'll most have me get a lawsuit. You can't blame a man on that. I wrote the damn shit. Don't want to put me on a record, you'll be rich. Here we got a donkey coming in, so maybe we won't.
Wow. Nice to see that demo tape worked out for him after all. You know, raw talent cannot be kept back. Just can't be. Don't even try. Well, thank you folks for stopping by for the inaugural broadcast from the diner. I'm James Lilex, and this has been the podcast for Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th, 2006. And nothing bad happened. It's going to be a good year. I can feel it. put that on my tab. Thanks.